Welcome back to Mountain Money. A few weeks ago, I needed to buy some chemicals for the hot tub, so I did a quick Google search looking for a good deal. But the next day, I started seeing ads for various spa chemicals in my Facebook feed. How did that happen? Facebook and Google are two of the most valuable companies in the world, and most of us use Google on an almost daily basis, but I, for one, certainly haven't paid either Facebook or Google anything. How are they making money?
The answer, of course, is these companies not only sell advertising, but they're in the business of monetizing data, your data. And the amount of electronic data that we as a society are generating is enormous. Cell phones broadcast where we are. Searches tell companies what we want to buy and what health issues are of concern to us. And the government and businesses not only have access to massive amounts of data, but they have incredible tools to search and refine that data. The change in the nature and the amount of personal data has happened very quickly. And the traditional rules surrounding privacy, which were formed pre the cyber world, have been left behind. So where do we go from here? This morning's guest is uniquely qualified to explain what is going on in respect to the collection, use, and dissemination of data, and how the rules should be changed to balance the roles of business, government, and your personal privacy and autonomy.
Michael Chertoff is the former Secretary of Homeland and the former Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division at the Department of Justice. He's now the founder and principal at the Chertoff Group, a security consulting and investment banking firm. A full disclosure, his illustrious career started when the two of us were young associates who worked together at a law firm many, many years ago. His book, Exploding Data, is about to come out in paperback and does an excellent job at laying out these issues and the challenges they present together with proposed solutions. Mike, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good to be on, Roger.
Okay. Mike, tell us a little bit about how this book came to be written.
Well, actually, when I was at the Department of Justice in 2001, as the head of the Criminal Division, I was there on September 11th, 2001, and had to be part of the immediate response to the terrorist attacks. As we tried to develop a program to prevent future attacks, what we came to realize was that the best way to identify potential terrorists coming into the country from overseas was by using data, and even a limited amount of data showing people's connections to other people was very, very important in identifying people who were high risk for the United States. So I was involved in the process of setting up a program really aimed at collecting data under court supervision to allow us to identify potential terrorist travelers. Fast forward, after I left government years later, I was at a conference, and I heard a very well-known individual who's a senior person at a platform company, whose name I won't mention, talking about the Edward Snowden revelations and what Snowden had said about U.S. government behavior in terms of data collection. And he was all outraged. And I said to myself, wow, you guys collect a ton more data than the U.S. government in its wildest dreams ever imagines collecting. They're collecting to save lives. You're collecting to sell things. Maybe we need to understand how these relate to each other. And so I got into the question of understanding how it is that data is being used by the private sector, and then talking about whether, as we move forward, we need to recalibrate our expectations about how the government operates and how the private sector operates with our data.
And one of the ways that we recalibrate as a society is really relying on the legal community. So we have this rapid development taking place in technology. We have this rapid development taking place on data and monetizing and using it for not only monetization, but to keep the country safe. Companies like Palantir are scrubbing thousands, probably millions of sources of data to identify these terrorists and work with the government to help do that. But there's also the legal environment in which they work. Talk to us about how the legal community has been able to keep pace with how quickly everything is changing.
Or not.
I was going to say we're not. I mean, if you look back historically, what has typically happened with new technologies is that for a while the legal community and the judges try to force the new technology into the old template. And finally, they say, you know what, this isn't working anymore. The template is broken, and we need to go back and redesign what we're doing. A great example of that is, for most of the first 100 years of the United States, our right to privacy was built upon property. You had a right to have sanctity of your home and your possessions, and the government couldn't search them. But as we developed the technology, for example, photography or telephones, what became evident is there were things happening with respect to photographic images or with respect to wiretapping that did not involve actually entering someone's home or getting involved with their personal property, but nonetheless were exposing their privacy in a way that was unanticipated. So eventually what happened is the court said, you know, this isn't really about property, it's really about privacy. And it's really about your ability to keep information to yourself if you don't want to share it. And so the law changed, and now we have rules about wiretapping and what can be done with photographs. Fast forward to the 21st century. The amount of data we generate now on a minute-by-minute basis, showing our location, showing our search history, showing what we buy at the store using a loyalty card, the amount is so vast that even if you argue that these are all public occurrences, the picture you can get out of somebody's life is far beyond what anybody could have imagined even 50 years ago. And that creates a real opportunity to manipulate or coerce people. And we need to start to think about how do we adjust the law so that we protect people's autonomy in the face of this cascade of data.
And you talk in the book about the concept of digital exhaust, and that is sort of what we generate in our day-to-day activities. Give us a few more examples of how we create digital exhaust, Mike.
So everybody understands if you sign up for Facebook, for example, they're going to have information about you. But let's take someone going through their regular day who's not doing any social media. So they get in their car. Both their car and their phone are generating locational data about where they are as they travel along. You stop at the grocery store to get some lunch. You pay with a loyalty card, which it gives you a discount, but also means that the supermarket now knows what you've bought. You may have a device in your car that monitors the way in which you drive, whether you accelerate suddenly and stop suddenly or whether you drive smoothly. When you get to your place of work, some places of work will have some kind of digital recording of when you enter and when you leave. If you use your phone to search for something because you want to go someplace after work, that search engine will record what you searched for. Now, all of these things seem like they are separate individual things. But what happens these days is much of the data is now migrated up to what they call the cloud, which is basically the server farm that houses data for a whole variety of different enterprises. It is possible to look at all the data in the cloud and correlate it together. Or it may very well be that the supermarket and other actors sell their data to a third party, and the third party aggregates the data. So basically, taking my little tour of a day in life, it is possible for somebody to pay for enough visibility that they can pretty much know much of what you did and where you did it and how you did it during the course of a day.
Now, Mike, let me ask you, there's two views you can take of this digital exhaust. One is, I'll start with the positive. One is you have this benevolent personal assistant who has your best interest in mind. And the more this benevolent personal assistant knows about you, the better they can help you. And the other is, you know, this evil partner that's looking at the data and trying to change your behavior so that they can make money. Where are we currently on that spectrum? Are we closer to the personal assistant, or are we closer to being constantly manipulated both monetarily as well as potentially politically?
Well, look, I mean, I don't want to impugn motives, but I would say that in practice, we're closer to the second model, the commercial exploitation model, than the first model, which essentially would be a digital version of your mother. You know, the companies that are aggregating the data don't love you and aren't looking out for your interest, although they are providing you in some respects with a valuable service. But ultimately, the purpose of collecting the data is to monetize it, is to produce a commercial value. And inevitably, whether it's sold to an employer or sold to somebody who's a marketer, that person is trying to get you to do something that is in their interest. And as the amount of data mounts up, the ability to give you the sense that you're constantly under scrutiny and being rewarded and punished, depending upon your behavior, in my view, creates the potential for a very oppressive atmosphere.
Well, let me ask you, there are companies out there that say, hey, we're collecting this data, but our focus is really on making your life better. You are not our product. You know, our products are our products, and that's how we make money. Do you believe that, or are you skeptical?
Well, I think it depends on the nature of the company and the company's business model. There are some companies which will sell you a product or a service, and they'll get money for it. And in that sense, it's very straightforward. They're not relying on your data as a way of making a profit. It's a straightforward, you give me cash and I give you the service. When your data is essentially the payment, then the question is, how is that data going to get monetized? And although I can imagine some circumstance where it's monetized for something purely, benign, there's also a risk that it'll be sold to somebody else and the purpose for which it will be adapted will be different than what you originally intended. That's one of the reasons why, for example, in Europe, they've got a new regulation that really requires, before a company repurposes your data, they've got to tell you and they've got to ask for your permission.
So what's happening now, Mike, I take it in some circumstances, is there are large companies, I assume, that are buying lots of data streams, trying to analyze them and repackage them, and then in turn turning around and selling that package of personal data to someone else who wants to sell you something. Is that basically what's happening?
That does happen reasonably frequently, yes.
So we've talked about, and I take it another one of the big developments that you discuss in the book is that while the amount of data is truly staggering, what's also developed with great rapidity is the ability to analyze and sort and make meaningful that mountain of data.
Yes, and that's what is sometimes referred to under the rubric artificial intelligence. And basically, artificial intelligence, which is also called machine learning, is about developing an algorithm that as you feed it data, the algorithm becomes, in quotes, smarter. It begins to detect patterns and adapt itself to look for those patterns and extract them. And this is a very efficient way to make use of amounts of data that would not really be useful to a human being because they could never review it all. I'll give you an example. Right now, the Chinese have announced that in the next decade, they want to be world leaders in artificial intelligence. And I think many people, including myself, believe that part of the effort that the Chinese are engaging in is collecting huge amounts of personal data, both from their own citizens and from the citizens of other countries. And these are so many terabytes of data that no human being could ever go through it and make any sense out of it. But by creating algorithms and feeding the algorithms, they can extract what they find meaningful out of all the data, and at the same time, they can increase the ability of the algorithms to even become more analytically sharp. So this becomes a way of actually building a non-human capability to extract value from large amounts of information.
So Mike, there are people in the world, and I would put myself in this category, that I like a lot of the features that come from this aggregating of data. Personally, I like the fact that when I do a Google search for something, and then later that night I'm watching some YouTube videos before I go to bed, that Google knows I was looking for something, and all of a sudden my YouTube feed gives me reviews on different products. it feels to me like it makes my life easier. And this may sound funny. It feels like it makes my life a little bit better. For people like myself, how would you react to statements like that? And maybe why I should change my behavior and maybe like do my searches incognito so they can't identify me?
Well, you know, I think it depends a little bit on your personality and your values, and it also depends on what you're searching for. So if you're looking for a pair of shoes, maybe you do find it useful to have recommendations come across your smartphone periodically thereafter recommending shoes you might like. But I'll give you another example. It's drawn from real life. Some years back, I was talking to a client, and we got on the subject of Gmail, and I said to her, oh, you know, and this is may no longer be true, but it was at the time, Google actually, in an automated way, reviews the content of your email and uses that to send advertising to you. And she got very quiet, and then she said to me, well, that explains something. And I say, well, what is it? She said, well, I've been in the middle of a divorce, and I use my Gmail to communicate with my lawyer. And all of a sudden, I'm getting ads for dating sites. Now, that's kind of creepy, to say the least, and maybe it invades the attorney-client privilege. So much of this may depend upon what you're searching for. If you're looking for some medical product because you've got a condition that you want to keep to yourself, you may not really like the idea that it's being disseminated to advertisers so they can send you remedies.
And
but if you're looking, as I say, for a pair of shoes, you may not care.
And it could also end up with your insurance company, which could in turn cause them to want to reevaluate your medical risks. So it's a...
Correct. And the insurance company could then say, oh, by the way, we've also got your credit card records and your discount records, and we see you tend to eat a lot of fatty food, and therefore you're not eating healthy. And by the way, your Fitbit tells me that your exercise pattern is very low, so we're going to raise your premium.
I want to segue, Mike, from the commercial sector to the government side for a few minutes. Our studio is 40 miles from Bluffdale, where the Utah Data Center is run by the National Security Agency. And you, in the book, you point out that at the doorway of the Utah Data Center, it says, "Welcome to the Utah Data Center. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear." I found that kind of chilling. Why is the government, how much of data is the government collecting, and how and why is it doing it?
Well, ironically, the government actually collects less than the private sector. But as I said a little bit earlier in the program, one of the reasons the government collects data is when you are looking, for example, for terrorists or for people who are going to commit violent acts, we don't have the equivalent of radar, which you would use to detect, for example, an enemy bomber or an enemy missile. The way we detect somebody who's a threat is by looking at a certain amount of data. And it doesn't necessarily involve very intimate or personal data. When we, for example, look back at the hijackers on September 11th, and we retrospectively examined some very basic information they had provided to the airline, like a contact number, a credit card, a telephone, an address, and a passport number, we were able to actually demonstrate you could have linked them, many of them together, and linked them to known terrorists before they got on airplanes on September 11th. So there are uses of data by the government that are very, very important in allowing us to focus on high-risk threats to our life and safety.
One of the things you talk about, Mike, is when we talk about the evolution of law to catch up with technology, is you talk about a paradigm that we might use going forward to sort of regulate how the government collects and uses data. In the book, you sort of suggest that we really can't do that at the collection stage as a practical matter. Can you address a little bit how you would sort of propose to regulate the government's use of data?
Yes. So, you know, typically when we talk about the government's ability to collect data, we have a kind of a binary approach. Either the government can collect and then it can do pretty much anything it wants to, you know, for a legitimate government purpose, or the government can't collect at all. And the threshold for collection, depending on the nature of the data, might be reasonable suspicion, it might be probable cause, signed off by a judge. And that makes a lot of sense at a time when the evidence that we were looking for was pretty straightforward and simple. But in the world of modern data, ironically, the significance of a piece of data might not be evident until you've collected a lot of other data, and then you want to go back and examine everything that you've got or that you might have gotten to see if it links up. The question is, what is the threshold for collection going to be, and is there a way to protect our rights but allow the government a little bit more practical ability to connect the dots, as we famously failed to do prior to 9/11. So my argument is, look, there should be a legal requirement for every stage of what the government does, but we ought to break it down into stages and to thresholds. So the mere collection or requirement that the information be collected perhaps gets one level of permission that's necessary. But I would be a little bit more generous in allowing the government to say that some kind of data ought to be held and maintained for a period of time so it can be retrospectively examined.
If
the examination part probably should require a higher level of permission. And then the ability to actually use the data should require yet a higher level of permission. So what I guess I'm suggesting is making the process of supervision by law over government data collection somewhat more granular rather than binary.
Which I take it would be a legislative solution.
It would be actually partly legislative, but it might also require some revisions in constitutional doctrine.
Wow.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Michael Chertoff. He was the past Secretary of Homeland Security. He's written a book called Exploding Data, Reclaiming Our Cybersecurity in the Digital Age. We've talked so far about big data and how that impacts us personally. We've talked about big data and the government's role in that. We've talked about terrorists, which is a very scary subject. And I, for one, frankly, am delighted that the government can get this information and find these bad guys. There's been multiples, there's at least dozens, if not hundreds, of cases where the government has been able to use that data to stop potential terrorist attacks. And I applaud that work. The part of your book, frankly, that was the scariest to me was talking about what could be acts of war. And thinking through that, I mean, people forget you can actually, you know, when you're in a war, one of the things you want to do is you want to cut off the supplies for your enemy. And you talk about in 2012, there was a large oil company, Saudi Aramco, that had 30,000 of their computers hacked. And what that did was that slowed and delayed petroleum delivery, which sounds like one of the first things a army officer would want to do. There was also a story, a reminder to us. I had heard it before, but, you know, somebody was able to successfully infect Iranian computers that controlled centrifuges that they were using to enrich nuclear material. And I think the world's a safer place because that did happen and that slowed down the development of it. But talk to us about the role of this data in cybersecurity and the potential for it to start wars.
Well, you know, people often think of what's on the Internet as just information. But actually, the Internet is often used to operate what we call industrial control systems. These are actually the systems that make things work in the real world. It might be your electricity. It might be your water supply. As we increase the number of, quote, smart devices, it might become your automobile. And in all these areas, interference with the Internet can actually have a real effect on people's lives and physical well-being. So an example of this, over the last few years, there were a couple of instances where the Russians hacked into the Ukrainian control systems for the electric grid and actually shut the lights down for a period of time in certain parts of the Ukraine. More recently, there was an attack of what we call ransomware, which is a kind of malicious tool that encrypts data and makes it really inaccessible, and that wound up shutting down the business operations of a number of companies in the Ukraine. We also saw an effort by Iranians at one point to attack a dam in the United States and shut down the system that controlled the flow of water. Fortunately, they didn't understand the dam they were affecting was a very small dam on a, in a little creek someplace in New York. But the point is, you can actually affect the physical world. And so the question becomes, and I think this is more and more a concern for national security officials, whether cyber is going to become a domain of warfare in the same way that the air, land, and sea are domains of warfare.
Yeah, in your book, you talk about the Secretary of Defense Ash Carter and what he believes would constitute an act of war in cyberspace, and he really talks about it being the seriousness, not the means of an attack, that matters most. I'm curious. I know we need to let you go, so closing question. Your view of the Russian influence on the 2016 elections, is that close to, was that bordering on an act of war in your view?
Well, the Russians do view what they call disinformation operations as an element of conflict or even warfare in some instances, because they recognize that if you undermine your adversary's will to fight and cohesiveness, you can actually undercut their ability to defend themselves. So I do think that what the Russians have been doing, not just to the U.S., but in Western Europe as well, is a form of conflict. Now, I'm reluctant to say it's warfare because I don't know that anybody has gotten killed, and we want to be careful not to throw the warfare term around too loosely. But it is certainly an element of what I would call geopolitical struggle or conflict. And they view it as a major element in their effort to reduce U.S. influence and raise their own influence, particularly in the region of Europe. So I think we're going to keep watching this. The Chinese also practice a version of this and also view information as a domain of conflict. And we need to be upping our game, so to speak, in identifying and blunting these efforts, because they can have a corrosive effect on our ability to defend ourselves against all manner of threats.
We've been talking to Michael Chertoff, who has been talking to us about his book, Exploding Data, Reclaiming Our Cybersecurity in the Digital Age, which I understand is about to come out in paperback. Highly recommended book. Mike, thanks for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Good to be on.
We'll talk to you soon.